Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give a special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Perpetual Chess listeners, two quick announcements before we get to this week's very fun interview with top Dutch player Jordan Van Forest. Number one, as Jordan and I discuss, How to Chess Season 3 is coming soon. The release date is TBD, but we are recording them now. Jordan is a guest among many others, so make sure you are subscribed to the separate How to Chess podcast feed or to the Chessable YouTube channel, or better yet, both. How to Chess, of course, is a chess improvement focused shorter form podcast that you can also find on YouTube. Number two, just your periodic reminder to make sure you're subscribed to the Perpetual Chess Link Fest, which is a weekly Friday email that summarizes or links to the best chess news stories I've read, the best chess blog posts I've read, the occasional video or podcast. But we try to just keep it short and keep you informed. And all you have to do is follow the link in the show description and submit your email address to get those. So without further ado, let's get you to this interview with Grandmaster Jordan Van Forest. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. I'm honored to be joined by a distinguished young guest this week. He is the 2016 Dutch National Champion, 2021 Tata Steel Masters Champion, the Dutch number two. He's a top 50 player in the world with a peak rating of 2715. He's also worked on Team Magnus, worked extensively with Dutch number one and recent Tata Steel Champion, Grandmaster Anish Giri, and he is now a Chessable author of Lifetime Repertoire's The Tarrasch Defense. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Grandmaster Jordan Van Forest to the show. Welcome, Jordan.
Hi, Ben. It's my pleasure. I'm really happy to make an appearance on the podcast. I already told you briefly before, but I've been listening to some of your earlier podcasts, and I think it's a great thing what you're doing.
Thanks. Much appreciated, Jordan. And obviously, I'm a big fan of your chess and have enjoyed your interviews recently on C-Squared and a little while back on Levi Rosman's currently dormant podcast, Gotham City. Rest in peace to Gotham City podcast. We hope it rises again. But of course, Levi's a busy guy. But Jordan, let's get to Tata Steel first and foremost. I know you talked about it a little with Fabiano and Christian Cordilla. You also did some insightful post-game interviews with Fiona Steele Anthony, but I got to talk to you about this game against your compatriot, Anish Giri. So you unleashed some crazy opening prep, and then you told Fiona after the game, you said, I found this really stupid idea, and I thought, let's give it a try. So I looked at the game, and of course, a lot of people will be listening to this rather than watching. So we can't go into too many variations, but I'm curious, you're renowned for your opening prep, your creative ideas. When you do find a stupid idea, is that typically something that happens at the board, or is it something that you cook up in the lab?
No, most of my ideas are definitely cooked up in the lab. Actually, the one specifically for Anish, I came up with it really briefly before the game. I was planning to play a different line, and then I came up with this idea, and I didn't really have any time to do any thorough analysis on it. So that's maybe that was actually a good thing, because if I would have done so, I would have felt that maybe it was unplayable. But sometimes when you're when you find something so shortly before the game, you don't have the time to actually analyze it. And I just decided to basically play it on a whim. Of course, I checked a few lines. One of them happened on the board. But I would say that with generally most professional chess players, the ideas they come up with, they're not, going to be thought of at the board, because usually they're not going to be as good, and you want to have them well checked. So definitely the same goes for this one. And the idea, I said it's stupid, because really black, if he finds a couple of good moves, is almost better, if not definitely better. But you know, it's never easy when you're actually sitting at the board and you have this pressure to actually find the best moves, and you know your opponent is going to be prepared with strong engine analysis, and you're actually playing an engine instead of a player.
Yeah, and I've heard top players like yourself talk about the fact that if an engine dislikes something, like Fabiano has said, that actually makes it more appealing these days, because if the engine just says something's good, everyone's going to have looked at it. Does that factor into your calculus as well, Jordan?
Well, of course. I mean, if the engine says it's bad, usually we don't look at it too much, but there are notable exceptions. And I think that finding those exceptions is one of the main, things professional chess players focus on when they're preparing, because of course the best moves, if you're just pressing the space bar or basically entering the first move, everyone is going to have looked at that. Sometimes it helps to look at them so you get a general feeling for the position, but in general everyone will have that basically well checked, and you're not going to get anywhere. So if you want to surprise the opening, you have to look at second rate moves and maybe sometimes go against the objectively best move just to surprise your opponent. But of course, there are many cases, and most of the cases, it's not like we're always going to play a worse move, because we're only interested in an idea when it seems that the opponent might be better, but actually it's not as easy as it seems. So, I mean, in most cases, of course, when you're making a bad move, the opponent just gets a nice position, and that's not what you want. So you kind of want to bring them in a tough spot where maybe they're actually having a better position than before, but practically speaking, the position becomes so much harder to play.
Okay, that's helpful. And I'm curious, like you say, I have a few questions that just curious to me as sort of a amateur player. You say you only had a little bit of time to check it. Is that because you're trying to limit your prep time, or is that because there's so much to check? I mean, people like Anish and Magnus, I can't imagine, like, how could you ever guess what they're going to play?
Yeah, no, especially with these two guys. I mean, I think you just named the two guys which play the most diverse range of openings. They basically both can play anything, and I would say with Magnus even more so than with Anish. It's basically just guesswork, but I guess in my case it kind of helps that I've worked with Anish before. I know his preferences, things he might dislike a little bit more. Of course, it's still just guesswork. For example, I wasn't sure he can play the Grunfeld, he can play the Slav defense, he can play the Rogozin defense, all main openings within his repertoire, but he can even play something like a King's Indian or Queen's Gambit accepted from time to time. So it's really just a lot of guesswork. And sometimes you guess right. Most of the time you do guess wrong. But I think being good at guessing what your opponent might want to play for this specific game against yourself goes a long way to, having good preparation on the board and getting a successful result in the game. For example, if you look at my first half in the tournament, you would maybe notice that I got quite bad positions out of the opening, and actually my guesswork was bad, and that also led to relatively bad results, whereas in the end of the tournament, I got positions I liked out of the opening.
And Tata Steel, of course, being one of the most prestigious tournaments of the year, so you've got a guess, and that makes it more challenging. How much time are you prepping for each game in total, Jordan?
It really differs. I would say that I used to prepare a lot more than I do now. The reason mainly being that the work has just sped up a lot. So the engines have become a lot stronger and things just go faster. So I also focus on conserving some energy. And that basically means that, for example, the night before the game, I'm not going to do as much preparation. I prefer to, you know, maybe watch a series, lay on bed, go for a walk or whatever, where I used to prepare a lot at night. So now I usually just prepare when I wake up. So basically my daily routine will be I wake up 9:30, go for breakfast, and around 10 I start preparing with my coach. And let's say, okay, maybe we have a quick lunch in between, I take a shower, but basically I would say I prepare maybe 3.5 hours before the game, which is definitely quite a lot, but not as much as I used to prepare. And some people like to prepare less, some people like to prepare more. It's really a personal preference.
Okay. And for the specific example of your game against Anish, how much time did you spend looking at this exchange sacrifice in particular?
Maybe half an hour. I would say it's hard to say because I'm working in different spots at the same time. So I might be checking this line, but at the same time, I'm checking another line. It sounds a bit weird, but I'm kind of all over the place. So maybe half an hour. I definitely put it up on the board and I asked my coach because sometimes when you're working with the engine, it gives you a bit of a biased view of the position. You cannot think straight anymore. So it really helps when you have kind of the human touch. And even if it's my coach is definitely not one of the best players in the world, but he's certainly a very strong player. And he will have maybe some human input, which the engine will, for example, not show and which I will not notice when I'm working with the engine. So I put the position on the board. I asked my second, actually, or coach, what would you play in this specific position? And that definitely helps. And I kind of noticed that he didn't seem to find the right moves immediately. And then I kind of started thinking, well, maybe this is actually interesting for the classical game as well. And then I, of course, backed it up with some computer analysis.
Okay. And is it a secret who your second/coach is?
No, not at all. It's Sipke Ernst. He was one of my first trainers, actually my second real trainer. So I worked with him starting when I was 13 years old, maybe worked for a couple of years, 2-3 years. Then I had a coach, Sergei Tiviakov, and I didn't really work with Sipke after that. But we always stayed in touch. We've always been on very good terms. We meet a lot. And at some point I was kind of looking for a second, and Sipke and me, we, like I said, we always had a good like chemistry together, I would say. So I asked him if he wanted to accompany me to some classical tournaments. So he has done that this year to Vikensee, and also last year he was already accompanying me.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure it's helpful to have someone there to bounce ideas off of and kind of see how they respond. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. And also you have to know that Vikensee is a terrible place at times. You know, I really like it there sometimes, but when you're playing bad tournament, you just need someone there to make conversation with, because it can be a really lonely place at times.
Yeah, there's this weird dichotomy. There's this sort of dual perception where obviously it has this grand legacy as a chess institution and as a traditional tournament, but it's also January and dark and like a summer resort from what I've heard.
Yeah, and this year it was particularly bad, I would say. There used to be snow, but that's not even that bad. This year it was just windy most of the time and very rainy, and that just sucks. You can't really go outside. I have to say, finally at the end of the tournament it cleared up a bit, the weather, but at the beginning it was just really terrible. And as a Dutchman, of course, I'm kind of used to it, which definitely helps, because some participants coming there for the first time, they're really like, you know, especially coming from a bit of the warmer countries, they're really wondering what they got themselves into. And, yeah, it can be a surprise to some people just coming for the first time. It's the weather definitely plays a role in how your tournament goes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's like I bet when it's going poorly, like the downs can get lower.
yeah, for sure. Yeah, you lose the game, maybe you want to get some fresh air, and you're like, oh no, it's raining terribly, there's a lot of winds, I'm just gonna stay in my hotel room, but it doesn't improve the mood.
Yeah, and of course you didn't start great by your standards, to be honest, so I'm sure it was helpful to have someone there. And that makes me another follow-up about this game against Anish in particular. So, and obviously in your game against Abdusatirov, of course, you also went for sort of a feisty line. The fact that you weren't contending for first place, as you've done in the past, does that make it easier to play risky openings, do you think?
Well, in general, I don't really go into the tournament playing for first place, so actually I would say I'm in my natural position when I'm somewhere at the bottom half of the tournament. That's kind of normal, I would say, considering my ranking. But of course, I always come there with ambitions. And indeed, there was really no pressure on me this time around as well. I mean, at the end of the tournament, I was just kind of looking forward to playing the two leaders, which is, of course, you know, kind of exciting. They have something on the line, and I have a chance of, you know, ruining their tournament, as I said in one of the interviews, and maybe kind of making my own tournament not as bad as it used to be. So definitely, I was looking forward to those games, and I think that gave me some extra energy as well to, you know, play some enterprising chess.
Okay, and what on that specific game? I wasn't clear. Not being someone who plays d4 as white, what was the specific novelty? Like you had this exchange sacrifice, and we shouldn't go into too many details, although curious listeners can certainly look up the game, and I'm sure some of you even are familiar with the game. Was it the exchange sacrifice itself that was new? Because Anish also talked about this c4 and c5 idea that you played a bit later in the game.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the first new move was h4, if you want to get into the chess specifics, which... I kind of came up with it because in a lot of lines, black pushes this g5 pawn push, grabs space on the king side, and I was wondering, well, can't you stop that? Of course, it looks a bit weird. And if you follow the engine, it kind of suggests that, well, you can do that, but then you have to already immediately give up the exchange. And it's interesting that Anish, after the game, pointed out that actually he was aware of this idea. But the thing is, even if you're aware of it, maybe it's stored somewhere in your computer. Actually remembering the details at the board is still a completely different story. If all of the professional chess players could remember all of their files on their computer, I don't think chess would be as interesting as it's right now. So the human brain still has, you know, its limits.
Even for Anish.
Even for Anish, yeah. I mean, he knows so much. I remember when I was started working with him for the first time, it was really... something amazing to see how much he actually knew.
Yeah, you're not the first person to tell a story like that on this podcast. And you're Jordan, you're always mentioned as a creative player, Anish. And I can't remember, I watched your Dutch TV interview, which we'll get to as well. That was fun to watch. But I think that was where Anish said that you have creativity beyond that of a regular grandmaster. And we have a question from a supporter of the podcast. Supporters of the pod can send in questions. And this one is on that theme. So Roy Lopes asks, he says, Jordan is a very creative player and says, quote, no idea is too good or too bad to warrant his attention. He said that was Magnus who said that. So he wonders in your games how you find the balance between taking risks and trying new ideas as opposed to playing solid lines. And in addition to what I asked you about the tournament circumstances, he's also asking, he's wondering if this decision is influenced by the opponent you are facing.
So the first question, how do I determine my ideas? It's a good question. I don't even know myself. I just know that sometimes I'm particularly attracted to an idea. And for me, basically anything goes. I don't mind the risks involved, unless it's maybe like completely losing idea. I don't like to play losing lines. But if like the worst case scenario is maybe your opponent is going to be slightly better at the end of the day, but they need to find 10 very hard moves, I'm not going to be not playing that idea. So there's some players who really like the objective to play objective chess, and they don't like to play slightly dubious moves in order to surprise their opponent, but I kind of do like that. So, of course, sometimes I do make wrong calls and the idea actually backfires. Maybe it was too risky, but you know, that's how it goes. It's a bit of a risky style, but that's what I like. And I have to say that nowadays it's becoming harder and harder to find those risky ideas because everyone is so well prepared. Everyone plays solid lines, where it's becoming harder to find those ideas. And if I decide on a certain opponent, if I'll play the idea, I certainly would say that is the case. If I do know the opponent very well, for example, when I'm playing an open tournament, I might not know my opponents very well. But when I'm playing Vikanzee, of course, even if I haven't played these guys too often, I have been following their game, so I'm quite familiar with their style. So, for example, you may think like a player like Wesley So is going to be very solid. So maybe you want to go for an attack against him or find some kind of idea like that. Whereas some players might be crazy, very, for example, Daniel Dubov is an easy example. Someone who likes to play very enterprising chess, so maybe I'll try to hit him with a more, you know, simple and strategic idea. Of course, all these guys are extremely good at every aspect of the game, but I kind of think about it a little bit at least, and think about their opening repertoires and all that kind of stuff. I think that's kind of part of the preparation.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and then we will be right back with more from GM Jordan Van Voorst. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable is the leading chess education platform known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which uses spaced repetition to help you remember stuff. What kind of stuff? Well, tactical patterns, opening sequences. It can even help you drill specific endgames. And of course, they have a huge library of courses to help you do that. They have courses both from prominent grandmasters like Grandmaster Jordan Van Voorst, Magnus Carlsen, Sam Shanklin, and they also have great material for club players, from club players. They have stuff for purchase, stuff you can check out for free. So be sure to go to chessable.com and check out what they have that is new. You should know what that sound means. That's the sound of another sale on Shopify and the moment another business dream becomes a reality. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. So whether you're selling chess courses, chess boards, or something totally unrelated to chess, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person so you can focus on successfully growing your business. It covers every sales channel, whether it's in-person point of sale system or an all-in-one e-commerce platform. It even lets you sell across social media like TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, packed with industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth. It gives you complete control over your business. And thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive course library, Shopify is there to help you every step of the way. What's incredible to me about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify is there to empower you with the confidence and control to revolutionize your business and take it to the next level. So now it's your turn to get serious about selling to Shopify. So sign up for $1 a month trial period, shopify.com/chess. By using the code chess, you know that they came from Perpetual Chess. So that's shopify.com/chess to take your business to the next level today. And we are back. And as a kid, obviously you were a top player, although you got a relatively late start for someone who's made it to your level. Do you think there was anything you were doing in your training that sort of built your creative muscle, or do you think it's natural?
I would say it's part of my personality. I have a lot of bad qualities, for example. I would say I'm terrible at cleaning up stuff. I'm very sloppy. I lose my stuff all the time. And I think that kind of goes together with being creative. So definitely it has its negative sides. So I've never been good at planning ahead, for example, and being a tidy and organized human. But okay, it has its advantages as well. So at some point I thought, like, of course it's good to work on some of your weaknesses, maybe even not on the chessboard but in life. But then, again, maybe if you work on some of those weaknesses, some of your strengths can disappear. So it's a bit of an interesting trade-off. Although, in general, I do recommend on working on your things you're bad at. But it's never as easy as it may seem.
So what did you consider your weaknesses as you were kind of climbing up the ranks?
Well, I think one of my main weaknesses is still blundering too often. I wouldn't say I'm one of the most accurate players. There are many more accurate players out there than me. Even in the Vikings A tournament, I made some really stupid blunders. And also, I may have some tendency to maybe make strategical errors. But it's hard to say exactly. I would say that definitely blundering growing up has always been my main weakness. And sometimes when I don't blunder, I can play really good chess. For example, in 2021, I don't think I blundered any tactics in the Vikings A tournament. And actually, I won the tournament. Whereas, for example, this year, in the beginning of the tournament, I made some really bad blunders.
Well, Jordan, basically everyone listening to this can identify with that. I certainly can. So we all want to know, what did you do to limit your blunders?
I guess just becoming a better chess player helped.
No, we want something easy.
The interesting thing is actually, I can tell you that So there's a lot of tactics apps out there. But what I would say that those tactics or websites, you know, and all the websites have a tactics trainer, they train you to spot tactics, of course, for yourself, but actually they don't teach you how to avoid tactics in a way. And my mom, actually, she's a programmer. She built an app which kind of focuses on also spotting threats and a tactics trainer, which I did very rigorously when I was about 14 to maybe 17 years old. The app has kind of, it was never meant to be commercial. It was more made for the family, although I think it's available somewhere on the internet. And definitely this app helped me a lot. So I did it every day for maybe an hour or so, spotting the opponent's threats. So she, for example, developed a segment into the app called threats, which means you have to identify the threat, and also something called blind chess. So you have to spot a tactic maybe from 8 moves away. So you are given the first 8 moves, and then it's like, here, solve this position. Another interesting thing she developed was a choose the move segment, which basically gives you a position taken from a grandmaster game, for example, and you're given 2 moves. One of them was played by the grandmaster and is wrong, and the other one is the computer's best choice. And actually, it's never at all easy to identify which one is the best move, even if you're just given 2 moves, because of course all these moves are played by strong players. And she kind of set boundaries. So for example, the move cannot be blunder. The evaluation between the best engine move and the grandmaster move can be no more than 100 centipawns. So a lot of these things help me, I guess, but mostly just working a lot on chess and playing tournaments is really useful.
You finally revealed the secret to the Van Forest success.
I think if you check out maybe my website, it's a bit outdated, but you'll find a link somewhere to the app. It's called Real Chess, although I'm not sure it's still available. So yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll look it up, and if it's there, I'll put a link to it in the notes, listeners. And if it's not, I'll put an apology in the notes. but we're glad to hear that. And I'd also just give a quick shout out to Dalton Perrine's Survive and Thrive course on Chessable, especially for club players. Also sort of, it sounds like it hits on some of the same themes. But Jordan, hearing you talk about how your mom kind of helped you behind the scenes makes me think of another question we have from a supporter of the pod. This is from Brian Karen, the founder of the the Facebook Chess Book Collectors group, which is like 50,000 members strong. I know you've read some chess books, Jordan. It's kind of crazy to see all the discussion of every book. Anyway, Brian's question is, taking into account your great-great-grandfather, who was a Dutch national champion, and uncle, your impressive siblings, your brother is a grandmaster, your sister is WIM, Machteld Van Forest, rising star in Dutch chess, and yourself, what is it that makes the Van Forest family so successful at chess? Do you draw inspiration from your relative success, or is it a coincidence that they happen to be strong chess players?
Yeah, for me, it really was a pure coincidence. I didn't know that they were strong chess players until I maybe became a decent chess player myself. So basically, the chess skipped a few generations in our family. My father didn't play any real chess. Maybe he was at the club, but he's no more than maybe a 1200 player. My grandfather the same. Actually, he got into chess because we got into chess at some point again. So he played once in amateur sections in Vikenzee, but I'm pretty sure he had forgotten about chess for a few decades as well. So I really see it more as a coincidence, but of course it's very hard to say, but I could imagine that the genes are part, some talent is there within our family, I guess, some kind of special chess talent. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what that would be, but it's definitely quite surprising if you think about it that like 100 years ago in our family there were 2 really good chess players. So in general, I think talent plays more of a role than people maybe think initially, at least if you want to get to the very, very top. So I think anyone can basically become a very good chess player. But if you want to become like top 100 or maybe number 1 in the world, I think talent will start playing a role. Even if you work very hard, you'll at some point just maybe not have any progress anymore or less than someone who would put in the same amount of effort but just has maybe a little bit more talent. For example, I think Magnus just has so much talent.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you've talked about this in other interviews, but getting to do training camps with Magnus, was there anything in particular that impressed you? Was there anything that obviously his reputation precedes him, but was there anything that when you witnessed it up close took you by surprise?
Well, I have a funny story that one, he joined the training camp on the first day. We started to play some blitz. And then maybe after like 4 or 5 games, he's like, okay, we'll continue till I win a game. But I just didn't win a game, you know. So after he won like 10 games in a row, maybe I made one draw in between. He's like, okay, we'll take a break. So what makes him so good? It's hard to say. But what I kind of noticed is that he just understands the game better than others. And that's a little bit strange if you think about it. Because, for example, from number 2 to number maybe 15 in the world, people are kind of changing. Like, for example, Anish has been number 2 in the world. Ding has been number 2 in the world. Maxime Fischer-Graf has been number 2 in the world. But then there's Magnus, who's always been number 1. So he clearly just understands the game a little bit better than the rest. And why he does, it's hard to say. But I definitely think there is some kind of special talent that he possesses that others don't. And you cannot make up for that by working hard. I think it's something innate. But like I said, you can become a very, very strong chess player, even if you'll have not as much talent as Magnus does.
That's a relief. And I heard you, I think it was in your interview with Levy Rosman, you mentioned that Magnus in these training camps kind of keeps his distance from the engine. He likes to be shown things on the chess set. You guys kind of present it to him. Is that something that, like, did you take something away from that for your own chess? Did that alter your approach at all, Jordan?
No, I would say I'm very much addicted to working with the engine when I'm training myself. So I guess it's just the kind of way I grew up playing the game. I feel like I can learn a lot from the engine. Magnus, on the other hand, indeed does seem to kind of prefer keeping a more fresh approach, not being biased by the engine. But personally, I see the engine as a great analytical tool. They're the best chess players in the world, basically, if you think about it. So why not try and learn how they approach certain structures, certain openings, try to learn from them. So I try to use them as a training tool, but it's very hard. I see many players, and of course myself also, they just stop thinking themselves entirely when they work with the engine, and that's the danger. So it's hard, you know, to kind of keep thinking yourself while using the engine, because you're just kind of like zoomed into the little box of the engine showing the moves, and you're just not even looking at the chessboard anymore. So it's happened to everyone, but I think if you find the right balance between looking at the board yourself, looking what the position is about, and at the same time using the engine as a tool, I think it's tremendously useful. But of course, what Magnus does also works very well for him. So I think there's just different approaches, and there's not one necessarily better than the other.
Okay. And these days, are you primarily using cloud-based engines, or are you still running them on your computer?
I think I stopped using engines running on my computer maybe in 2018 or something, when one of my Dutch colleagues told me about, you know that you can actually, at the time I was using chess-based cloud, that you can use chess-based cloud to rent engines, and they're going to be like 10 times as strong as your laptop. Before that, I was always, you know, looking for the best kind of laptops, specifications on the website, maybe looking at an amount of cores or whatever. At some point, I even bought a desktop PC because, of course, you can put more CPU power in that. But nowadays, when I'm, for example, buying a laptop, I just only focus on the weight I don't want it to be too big. I want it mostly to be easy to carry around. So really, I think all professionals switch to using their engines on the cloud. It's simply so much more convenient. You pay a little, but really, at the end of the day, it's well worth your the price.
Okay, and are you still using Chessbase Cloud?
No. The reason being that, first of all, I found cheaper options, but at the sometimes when you're playing tournaments, you can see that all the engines are going to be used by your competitors, which I didn't really like. And also, there's a slight risk that one of the engines you're using it's a bit hard to say, but if you're renting out an engine, for example, anyone can rent out an engine for others to use at a certain price, and people can rent that engine, but actually the person renting out the engine can see what the other person is analyzing, and they can see the name of the person who's using it. So, of course, what you could do, you could create an anonymous account, but still, I didn't like that it wasn't fully anonymous. Definitely one of the things I think could be improved. But I currently just have a cheaper and, in my opinion, better way of working with engines.
Okay. Yeah, there was, of course, that story during the Magnus Nepo match where someone had been looking at one of the lines that appeared. Do you have any inside intel you could share on that story, Jordan?
Yeah, there was definitely a little bit of panic. I don't think I was personally as concerned, but other team members may have been.
Very diplomatically.
Yeah, it was very strange. Like, I don't think finally we decided, like, it could have just been random. We don't know what happened. But definitely, yeah, there was a little bit of concern. So what did we even do? I don't think we did actually anything in specific, we decided we're gonna be extra careful, I guess, from that moment onwards. But it was definitely surprising, because it was one of those very obscure lines which was somehow already checked before the game was played. So it could also have been from the opponent's team, that someone of them left the, because if you're working in chess base, which basically all professionals do, you have a certain thing called the live book, where if you can switch it on or off. Usually most people switch it off, but you can by accident leave it on. And then the moves you're analyzing are actually being put in the live book. So either just a totally random person analyzing this totally random line by chance analyzed this, or one of the team members of either Napo or Magnus left it on, but we never figured out who it was. But it was definitely a bit of a reason for at least some concern. But fortunately, finally in the match, I don't think it really mattered. And yeah.
Okay, with your story about like losing your keys, I was a little worried that you had been implicated.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, could have been me. I don't think it was. I always have it switched off. It's actually never on. But like I said, I'm definitely one of the sloppier guys. So if I'm very used to losing keys, I lost my laptop or a passport, for example, a few times as well. So, looking after myself, definitely not my strong suit.
Well, Magnus is famous for that too, right?
Really?
I feel like he is. Yeah, I feel like I've heard stories of him losing, maybe it's his phone a bunch of times or something like that. But anyway.
I think a lot of chess players I know seem to, you know, not be able to look after their stuff very well. I don't know if that's a thing generally with chess players or just the people I surround myself with. But maybe Magnus is also, you know, somehow like we're always thinking about chess or whatever. And then suddenly you look and where's my phone or where did I leave my keys or whatever. Yeah, so they were just a bit, we're always a bit confused.
Okay, well, Jordan, we've got a bit of time left, and I should say for listeners, Jordan graciously is How to Chess Season 3 is recording, and we're going to do actually two pods. So we're going to do a bit more on Perpetual Chess, and then we will record a separate interview about Jordan's chess role models that will be released later. But Jordan, I want to get a bit behind the scenes of your recent Dutch talk show appearance. I believe the show is called...
Skeleton Sophie.
Yeah, thank you. So it's Khaled and Sophie, Dutch popular general interest talk show filmed in front of a studio audience. So first of all, you and Anish crushed it. So congratulations. It was nice to see that you guys, I mean, obviously it's primarily for a Dutch audience, but yeah. It was posted on YouTube with subtitles that I'll link to. But you guys are great representatives for chess, and that's always nice to see. But to me, it must, like watching from the outside, it must have felt mildly surreal. Like what was that experience like for you, and how does that compare to playing, say, a high stakes OTB chess game?
First of all, I'm happy you managed to find a video with subtitles, because I was kind of wondering if you got anything, but that's good. So actually, I've done a couple of these things before. There's another Dutch popular talk show, I'm saying podcast here, but talk show called Jinek, which I've appeared on twice. So I kind of knew what was going to happen. That's also why I wasn't actually very nervous before the start of this one, but I can tell you that when I won WAEC 2 years ago, I also was allowed to come on a talk show, and that one was the one called Yinek. And I remember one of the producers said before the talk show, like, you know, Jordan, it's really important that if you want to go to the restroom, you have to go now, because during the the broadcast, you're not allowed to leave the seat. Yeah. And of course, my item was like right at the very end, so maybe the talk show in all in all 1 hour, and I was at minute 50. And around minute 40, I started feeling like, okay, I need to go to the toilet. Yeah, it was really bad. So I kind of sat there, bouncing around a little bit. And at some point, I decided, look, okay, I can't handle it anymore. So when there was like a little video shown on some other item, I asked one of the producers, well, can I please visit the restroom? And he's like, looked over to his colleague, he's like, yes, you can, but 30 seconds stops. So I went, came back, and actually after that, I felt very relieved. So, doing the talking bit was super easy from then on. So that's when I was very nervous. But this time also, I think being there with Anish was kind of nice. It's always nicer when it's two of us. I think it was just, we had a little fun evening. It wasn't anything super special, actually. But it's always nice when there's some interest shown in chess. Of course, we very much embrace that and are happy to see. So that's why we decided to do it.
Nice. It's funny, but as a classical player, you should be used to like plotting out your bathroom trips, you know?
Yeah, but somehow during chess games, you're allowed to go whenever you can. So, of course, it's at own risk. You may lose the game on time, or you have to go in time trouble. But here, he really said it's a no-go. So I guess it was a bit different. But yeah, maybe I have to work on planning my bathroom trips a bit more.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and then we will be right back with more from GM Jordan Van Voorst. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. aimchess has an algorithm that gathers your games from the major chess playing sites like chess.com and leechess, and then gives you actionable intel on how to improve your game. It evaluates different phases of the game, tells you how you're doing with certain openings, and they're constantly rolling out new features to make Aim Chess even better. Some of the new ones include a blunder preventer drill that you can do, and they've now got blindfold exercises where you can work on your chess visualization skills. So be sure to check out Aim Chess if you have not already. And if you decide to subscribe, then use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. You can also click on the link in the show description to aimchess.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we are back. And speaking of classical, I feel like there's been more and more talk about the move online, the move to faster chess. You're a young guy. I've heard you mention that you don't consider yourself a great blitz player, at least in comparison to classical. How do you feel about this raging debate of classical chess, in Magnus's words, potentially being phased out?
Well, I definitely don't think it's ever going to be phased out, because it's still the most popular, actually maybe no more. I was going to say it's the most popular time control at every level, except for the very highest level. But of course now everyone is playing online, which is a bit different. But I would say that only the preparation of extremely deep, openings, comes in at the very high level. So maybe if you're speaking above 2600 level, which is maybe only very, very small, percentage of the actual amount of chess players. So, at any other level, there's really no need to have this kind of amount of opening preparation. Although, of course, it's becoming more. I mean, everyone is becoming more booked up. Chessable courses being available everywhere. Opening books are becoming better. But still, the opening preparation is not going to be the same as of the professional players. But even if you look at a tournament like Vikenzee, I think you see plenty of decisive results. I don't think that there's a problem of draws in chess. I think maybe the main thing, or the main reason why people prefer faster time controls, is because it's just more what fits in with the contemporary world, with everything going faster, everything being done on a second-by-second basis. You have all these social media apps which constantly, you know, give you new feedback, show you new things. So people don't have the patience anymore to watch a seven-hour chess game. People prefer watching a chess game that max lasts 10 minutes maximum. So I think that's one of the reasons why we see a shift towards Rapid and Blitz. Personally, I enjoy all time controls. Actually, maybe I enjoy Blitz the most. But like you already mentioned, I think it's my worst time control simply because I blunder too much. I really hope that all the time controls will stay. And I think actually this year is a good year for classical chess with the FIDE cycle being there. And I heard, for example, from Anish that he's playing a lot of classical tournaments. So I think for now, you know, we should just try to keep all the time controls around. And if there's more Blitz, that's great. But it would be a pity to see classical chess fade away only because Magnus says he is maybe not as interested anymore. Really, the idea I get this from most people is that they're still very much interested in classical chess, though.
Glad to hear it. And Jordan, what do you have coming up tournament-wise?
Actually, very little at the moment. I'm playing first classical tournament in Sweden, in Malmö, in May, I believe. I may play a couple of open tournaments in April or probably not March. But for me, it's a bit of a quiet period. I'm having a training camp pretty soon, probably, but tournament-wise, it's quiet. And that's because although there are many classical tournaments, I think, this year for the absolute top players, I think that for people in my spot, it's not as easy to find tournaments. Because, okay, the open tournaments are not necessarily as interesting and very and lucrative. Well, there's still a quite decent opposition there. It's not exactly what I'm looking for. And the absolute highest top tournaments are, you know, a little bit out of the question. So it's not that easy, but I'm sure I'll find something.
Does that bother you at all? Like, do you feel any sort of injustice about it, or just it is what it is?
Yeah, I think that's just what it is. I mean, you see in every sport that people want to have the best players. But it does give me motivation to get better at chess. And maybe this does mean that sometimes I have to play a tournament which is not going to be able to give me as much income just to try and increase my rating, which I actually tried that earlier in December in an open tournament in Sitges. I don't really usually play open tournaments anymore, but also I know that these tournaments are very tough. Everyone is going to be underrated, and you're easily losing rating. So actually I lost 10 points there, but I might give it another shot. But yeah, I think it's just what it is. It's always been that way, that the top players, you know, get to play the most interesting tournaments. I think that it should be that way, but of course I would always you know, welcome new tournaments, maybe for players who are not at the very top but are still very, very good. So that would be nice, of course.
Reasonable perspective. And Jordan, I asked you how you worked on your game when you were younger. Now, as you mentioned, obviously an incredible player, but still striving to get better. How do you work on your game now?
Well, I would say that a lot of time goes into working with the engine on openings most of the time, actually. But for example, I also try to keep fresh. I don't really use my mom's app that much anymore, but I do from time to time. Also, I think that websites do have excellent tactics trainers, which I like to use, and a lot of practice as well, you know, with other strong players helps me. So there's a lot of, you can always find a game online, for example, to play, which I think is good practice. Sometimes I read a book, which is not really, which I don't really see as training, but it's definitely always going to be a bit useful, and it's mostly enjoyment. But I would really say that most of my time is simply working at home with the engine, which I do enjoy, but it's just what it is, I guess.
Okay, and any books you've particularly enjoyed lately?
Okay, well, I haven't read it yet, but I really want to. I've written the foreword, actually, of the book. I haven't read it entirely. Sounds weird, but I know it's really good book. So I wanna start on Tyviakov's Rock Solid Chess book, which just came out by New Chess. So I think that one. But yeah, usually it's just gonna be some opening books, but nothing otherwise. Really particularly I enjoyed, I think.
Okay, and we will be discussing books a little more in our How to Chess segment, which we should get to momentarily, Jordan. So we'll wrap things up here on Perpetual Chess. But I did want to discuss your Tarrasch course briefly. Tarrasch was actually my first opening against D4. So it has a special place in my heart. And I, like you say in the course, I've always felt like it's a bit underutilized, especially because I know club players are often looking for open positions against D4. And you mentioned your King's Indian player. I think a lot of them, even though it's not necessarily open, it's at least attacking. So a lot of them end up on the King's Indian. But what was your odyssey to selecting the Tarrasch?
Well, what you mentioned, I feel a lot of players want to look for an attacking repertoire against 1d4. And against e4, it's quite simple, of course. You get the Sicilian defense, and you can basically pick anyone you like, the knight or variation, Taimanov, dragon, whatever. But against 1d4, it's not as easy. Of course, there's a King's Indian defense. I don't think it should be called the defense, actually. It's more of an attack, but okay, there's already another opening for that when white plays that way. But I always had a soft spot for the King's Indian defense. I really like the opening, but what I've come to notice is that in a lot of positions and variations, black is not actually attacking, and the position or positions become relatively close, and actually the play becomes extremely strategical and hard to play for both sides, actually. So it's a really interesting opening, but I think at its core, the King's Indian nowadays is more of a strategic opening, which is really interesting. But I feel like there should be other ways as well, you know, to play an enterprising game against 1d4. And I wanted to learn something new myself as well. And then I basically stumbled upon the Tarrasch defense. It's been played very much by Kasparov in his early 20s, maybe, or early career at least. And he did really tremendously well with it until he hit, the great player that Anatoly Karpov is. But until then, he had some massive victories with it. He crushed the opposition in style. And really, the Tarrasch has been kind of under the radar ever since. You know, there's been some ideas here and there, especially the Dubov Tarrasch has come around. But I felt like the proper Tarrasch, the traditional Tarrasch should you know deserves a new look. So I kind of started to look at it, and actually, if you look at it with the modern engines, you can notice that it's perfectly playable. And the great thing about this is also that you do need to get open positions, but it's a super easy repertoire. It really works against D4. Super smoothly. You don't have to worry about move orders too much. You just play d5, e6, c5, bring out the knight, bishop e7, and castle. And that part I liked very much. I've played it a couple of times. I would say that the positions are very dynamic, very interesting. So if you want to add a new, you know, line to your repertoire, definitely go check it out.
Yeah, and of course we will link to that. It's obviously you're getting an isolated queen pawn some of the time, although not necessarily in the c4 line that you recommend. And the other thing I would just mention for listeners is, as always, or as frequent with Chessable, there's a short and sweet variation, so listeners can check it out for free. So just one or two more questions here on Perpetual Chess, Jordan. This has been awesome. Number one, and you can punt on this if you feel the need, but Ding or Nepo, how do you handicap that match?
I was definitely going to say Ding before Vakansay, but now I honestly might have to change my mind here. What Ding showed in Vak, of course, it doesn't necessarily have to influence his match against Nepo, but I mean, I can't imagine it did him any good. There's been cases, for example, where Caruana did very well after doing terribly in Vike in the Candidates tournament, but in general, losing 23 ratings or whatever it was in Vikenze cannot have given him any confidence. And it should have brought Nepo a lot of confidence, I guess. So honestly, might have to go with Nepo in this one. Now, although I really hope for a super exciting match, and I'm sure it will be, actually. So either way, it's going to be close. But I think by this point, I'm going with Nepo simply because of Ding's Vikenze result, and maybe the fact that he hasn't played a lot as well ever after the Candidates tournament. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of lean in the same direction. And let me ask you, Jordan, you talk in your C-Squared interview, as did Anish, about sort of the evolution of your relationship. Obviously, you worked for him for years. Then you worked with Magnus, and it came out a little bit that maybe there was a bit of friction about that. And I really appreciate it, and I think a lot of chess fans did, the way that you guys addressed that. And it was great to hear that obviously you guys are doing talk shows together, you and Anish, and communicating. But basically, this is a long way of asking, if you were invited to work on the team of Nepo or Ding, A, would you be interested? And B, like, is that even allowed under your current sort of professional arrangement?
I have to think about both questions. I'm pretty sure it would be allowed, but it would be, I'm not sure it's what I want right now. I would say that I've been working a lot with players, and it's brought me tremendously much, both working for Anish and working for Magnus. I've learned so much from working with the both of them, but currently I'm already 23 years old. You look at some of the youngsters, they're 16 years old, like Gukesh, and I feel like it's time I really work for myself and start improving my own game. So definitely wouldn't entirely say no, but at the moment I'm mostly interested in working for myself.
That makes sense. And I know you, again, you mentioned you took inspiration from Anish sitting at the computers 10 hours straight when you work with him.
Yeah, no, his drive to work is something I've never seen before. So huge respect for that. I don't know how he does it, but it's definitely, I think there's definitely talent to work hard, and he definitely possesses it as well. So, yeah.
And he, sorry, I meant to ask you this earlier, and he, unlike Magnus, he's at the computer when he's working. He's not setting it up on a board.
Yeah, no, like what I said, there's definitely different approaches to working. I would say Anish works in more or less the same way as me. Of course, there's going to be slight differences here and there. He's more structured when he works. He has certain preferences, but at its core, we both work at our laptop with our engine. So if we're having a training camp, for example, it's going to be Anish with his laptop, me with his laptop, maybe a couple other people with their laptops, and there's going to be a chessboard, but it's going to be the chessboard that's, it's not going to be touched as much as the computer's virtual chessboards. So that's basically simply how we work. And I would say that really Magnus is more of an exception than a rule at how he works. If you look at the current players, at least from what I know, is that most of them do like to work with the engine, and Magnus basically really distancing himself from the input of the engine is very interesting. But you should, of course, not forget that he gets to see a lot of computer lines. I mean, all the files he looks at, all the analysis he receives is going to be backed up by extremely strong engines. It's just not that he actually switched on the engine himself. So he's going to see all the best moves in all the positions. And he is able to do this as well because he's able to have a strong team to work for him at most tournaments he plays. But what I said, it's a bit unusual. But of course, I mean, you can't argue with the success he has had. So
You certainly cannot. All right. Well, Jordan, we're going to do another quick interview, but thanks for coming on Perpetual Chess. Listeners, be sure to check out the Tarash Defense Lifetime Repertoires. Do you have a preferred social media for listeners to root you on, Jordan?
Yeah, you can check out my Twitter. I'm not as active as my countryman Anish Giri, but I tweet a couple times a year. So you can check me out there. And I also post once or twice on Instagram, but I think Twitter is what most chess players are into.
Okay, sounds good. And thank you, Jordan. That's been an honor, and I've learned a lot.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters, those who choose to join that community based on their level of support. support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on...
Podcast Network.